All right, so earlier on, a listener had an embarrassing situation, really. They bought their ticket for the Donegal-Tyrone game at the weekend, turned up at the gates, and the internet was poor, probably because so many people were in the area. They struggled to get the ticket up onto their phone, and there were people behind them. Bit of friendly banter, but still they felt uncomfortable about it. James, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too. Right, you've bought your tickets online in the past. And I talked about screenshots, and this is a rebuttal to that. I'm giving wrong advice, am I, James?
That's right, yeah. Well, normally I would screenshot as well, just in case the phone go dead or whatever.
Mm.
Because myself and my wife, you know, if one of our phones goes dead, at least the other person has a screenshot on their phone. So we've done the usual thing, going to GA matches or whatever, take screenshots, and it's never a problem, really. But last weekend at the Dermot Kennedy concert, I had my screenshot as usual, ready to go. And I got as far as the girl, and she tried to scan it once, then the second time. No good. She says to me, "That wouldn't be a screenshot by any chance." And I says, "Yeah, it is, actually." And she says, "No, this doesn't take screenshots. It kind of has to be the original, whether it's a fraud prevention or whatever." But, you know, before this, I never had a problem anywhere, whether it was boarding passes at the airport or, you know, GAA games or whatever, never a problem.
Yeah.
This is the first time I ran into this problem.
All right, okay. So that's, because as I say, my experience just was like, you know, at the airport, and I think actually in a concert, I don't know which one it was, because I went to my first concerts ever last year and I happened to go to two. Right, okay. So in your experience, screenshots no good. So then you go looking through the emails, which is clearly, unless you're very different, full of spam. You're trying to find out the right email, and you got it in the end, but presumably you had to let people through. I think you mentioned that.
Exactly, exactly that. I wouldn't be really a contributor either. It's more GA games and boarding passes, as you say. But when I wouldn't scan, then I had to go searching through my own private emails and letting people buy. And just, it's a whole inconvenience.
Yeah, of course.
But if we knew in advance that this was a new technology they were using, that, and I can understand where they come from. I suppose you could pass on tickets by, you know, fraudulently by scanning them or whatever and passing them on. But on this occasion, I was caught short. So I suppose going forward, I'll have to be more switched on and have my emails ready rather than any screenshots. Or
right, okay, good advice, James. Let me ask you, what took you then as a non-concert goer to Dermot Kennedy? Did you take one for the team?
Pretty much took one for the team. But yeah, no, my brother-in-law had two spare tickets and they asked me if they want. I said, well, and I quite like Dermot Kennedy, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a problem going to him. It was a fantastic concert.
Good. He enjoyed it, did he? Because I saw him in, I didn't see him in the flesh. I saw his set at Glastonbury and I mean, I wouldn't call his music uplifting, but he's a brilliant vocalist, that has to be said. Yes. You enjoyed it nonetheless, James?
I very much enjoyed it. We all enjoyed it. The weather was brilliant. The venue was brilliant. So it was a great evening all round.
Lovely. Great stuff. Great. You had a good time. And also great advice too, that whether they used to work in the past, at least at some gates, they might have changed the technology, probably to stop people using the same ticket over and over, that they want the original. James, thanks for that great advice. Really appreciate it.
No problem, Greg.
Have a lovely day. And I really appreciate you listening as well. Thank you very much indeed. Right. Greg, are Coleman Legal only dealing with Republic of Ireland cases? What about Northern Ireland? I know the answer to that in the back of my head. Caroline, is it possible we could just double check with Coleman Legal if people from the North can enter that? I don't want to mislead anyone. As it relates to that case as well, it says on his site it's free to join, but it also says if the case is successful, there'll be a small fee charged in each successful case. How much is small? I don't know the answer to that question either. Maybe that's also something we'll just double check with them. I find it hard to understand what makes many of these RTE presenters worth a fraction of the wage they're on. Let's face it, RTE is no competition for them to go, because there is no way a privately owned radio station could offer a fraction of what they are on. But hats off to Noel Kelly, the agent who's talked these presenters up to these deals. Indeed, and I think, you know, we were speaking to Garrett Hart, who was involved with News Talk, very high up in News Talk yesterday, and he was part of the negotiating team that brought Pat Kenny on board to News Talk back then. I think there was a time maybe they could command money close to that in the private sector. Those days are absolutely gone now. And I think they all should be offered, what would be fair, 150K? Would you get out of bed for 150K a year, Frankie?
Definitely.
Right,
no problem.
Okay, so we'll say offer them 150K. Take it or leave it. If you want to continue working, you can do so. If you don't, you don't. That's up to you. Right, okay. Mm-hmm. What would be a good fee? What do you think would be a worthy fee out there, listeners, for presenting a top show on a national station? 08660 25,000. Right, okay. It's that time of the year again. 7th of July, party in the park. Frankie McGreevy, our generation manager at Donegal Youth Service, joins us. Exciting, isn't it, as you build up to this summer spectacular?
Yes, you can. The excitement's palpable right now down Donegal Youth Service. There's bands in practicing, and there's art graffiti workshops going on. Everybody's building up to the big day. So it's July 7th, Friday, 12 until 6, and we're going to have all kinds of events for everybody.
Yeah, I think what's, I mean, obviously, look, this is about giving people an alcohol, drug-free space to go and enjoy concerts. But I think this is great for the performers. It gives them an amazing platform in front of a lot of people, which I think is a real cracking element to this.
Ah, it's amazing. You know, what happens is, you know, young people get together. There might be 15, 14-year-olds. They maybe have 4 or 5 practice sessions. They're in a band. Then they go up to the park and they turn the corner and they see a stage that you would see in Glastonbury. Mm. It's huge, mm-hmm. you know, and it really gives them confidence then to move on from that. Just while I mentioned Glastonbury, the Murder Capital are playing Glastonbury, and Gabriel Blake, his first ever gig was at the Party in the Park.
So, really?
And he's the bass player for the Murder Capital, who are taking over the world at the minute.
Fantastic. So,
and there are other stories like that. You
and
know?
There's a mixture of established artists and new artists and what have you at this concert. But what impresses me, and you know this more than I would, Frankie, you know, with a better understanding of music, is that, you know, these young people aren't just getting together and trashing out noise.
No.
You know what I mean? They're making brilliant music, and some of the songwriting lyric, you know, the way they form the words and the meanings relevant to them. It's really, really genuinely impressive. They're really using the music to express themselves, but doing it in a fantastic way, I think.
Yes, most definitely.
You know, I've never had anyone in here, and we've had lots of young bands that go, oh, lads, you know.
Yeah, well, we've got one plan. I was speaking to Caroline, then we've got one coming in next week in the lead up. They're a band called Dirt Tax. Mm. I think they were on the Monday night sessions before, and they're very young, you know, but they are fantastic.
Yeah, brilliant.
They're really, really good.
All right, we'll talk more about the event and the ethos and all that kind of stuff, but run through some of the acts that have been...
Well, this year we've 18 bands, which is, you know, extraordinary. Just to name a few, we have Cora Harkin over from Derry. We have the 9 Foot Lizards. We have the Upper Echelons, which are from our breakout LGBT group. We have Raheem, we have Hannah McFadden, we have Destined and the Blue Stack from the Blue Stack Special Needs Project over in Donegal, and they played at our celebration event in Belfast. They are unbelievable, incredible. It's great for them, and we had to build an access for people with disabilities to the stage this year, which is good. It's a new development for us. We have Dirt Tax, who I mentioned, the Fades you've had up here. Fantastic band. They have a new single out. Ella Fitzgerald, who's very aptly named. She's got a beautiful voice. She's incredible. Aaron Everything, more established. He's playing tonight in the Mouthpiece in the Cottage. Very, very good. Brilliant voice. We have the Future Generation Dancers, who we had last year. And they are a group of young people from the iPass Centre. Had just opened up then last year. And they lit the place up because we had 4 hours of beautiful weather, and then we had a biblical downpour for 2 hours last year, and they stayed and they danced in the rain and it was just absolutely beautiful to see. So they're back, you know. And then along with that, of course, we have the activities there. You know, we've got the Circus Skills In Your Space crowd are coming up from Belfast to do the Circus Skills. We have a group called Tackling Awareness of Mental Health Issues. They're TAMI, they're called, and they specialize in games for young people. Face painting, the old classic, hair braiding and henna tattoos, art workshops, everything.
Yeah, and two, I mean, you mentioned Glastonbury. like this is almost like the breakout stage to some extent, you know what I mean, in that you mentioned the Murder Capital connection there, but there's other bands that are household names now, not just locally, but, you know, have got recording contracts, their music's reaching, you know, loads of people across the world through streaming platforms and what have you, that have played this stage in the past.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right, without a doubt.
Okay. Right. Okay. So the whole idea of this is that it's drug and alcohol free event. It's during the day. It's a brilliant platform for the artists, as you mentioned, but it's a good fun day with lots going on, a buzzy festival feel for the young people and their families.
Absolutely. Remember the family bit, you know, and it's for all ages, you know, and we get that every year, and there's going to be food provided and just a real fun atmosphere for everyone, yeah. You know.
Now, at the bottom of the poster I have, there's a call for artists, talents and band. Has that call been met now, or is that still out there?
We can't get any more in, I'm afraid.
That's what I was thinking. I was looking down thinking, well, where are you going to squeeze them in?
Yeah. I'm not directly running it this year, but I'm famous for letting everybody play, and we've had all kinds of, we've maybe had 25 of too many.
Yeah.
But we're at our limit with that time period, 12 to 6, with 18 bands, so I'm very impressed with that. I must mention that it's funded this year through the Our Generation project, which is a Peace 4 funded project. So we have some bands coming over from Derry and a cross-border element to it. But we also have this year secured funding from the Connecting for Life HSE anti-suicide project, or suicide prevention project. So they've provided funding for the stage.
Great.
So that's great. So a big shout out for them.
17 years in. Long
yeah,
time,
we're flying, hey, you know, and if you count the pandemic, which we can't really, we would be at 19, but yeah, delighted. We started, you'll know John Ruddy, I'm sure, from being around, and myself and John Ruddy and maybe 7 or 8 other young people back in 2005, I think it was, sitting on the steps.
Was your hair a little darker then?
Oh, yeah, much so, very much so.
I was as bald as a baby.
But yeah,
17 years ago.
It was just bored out of, we got nothing to do. And I was a youth worker. I said, well, we've got this big park and we've got you guys with skills. Let's go up and sit on the steps and play music. And then we went, well, maybe this could grow. Mm. And it has, thank God.
It's lovely. And it's still, and it's now, it's a new generation of people that are sitting around wondering what we can do. Well, yeah. We've a stage for, you know, get up there and do your thing. Exactly. So you're bringing in live music to us next week, is it?
Yes, band called Dirt Tax.
Dirt Tax, all right.
So I'll have to figure out the time, but I spoke to Caroline. Caroline says there's lots of space, so...
Yeah, well, that's above my pay scale. I'll leave that to you and Caroline. We can't mention pay now, can we? And we can here anyway. All right, listen, well done, Frankie, for what you and the rest of the crew are doing in keeping this going. As I say, brilliant for the audience, but as I say, I think particularly... and when the Afades were in here, I was saying to them, what I'd love to see is you know, when you go to some of the concerts or festivals that are going on around the place and they're playing music out of the speakers for an hour before everything starts, I'd love to see the young bands get an opportunity to get up there and not even just young, new,
new,
to get up there and say, well, we'll fill that gap with this crew here.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a brilliant stage and platform for them. It is, just mark it into your card, 7th of July, 2023. There's no booze, no drugs. There's graffiti workshops, games on the green, live music, circus skills, face painting, and Tammy Project will be there, as we mentioned as well. So much more besides. And we'll talk about it more earlier on when we welcome up that band to play here. All right, Frankie, thanks as always for calling up. Appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Greg.
Fingers crossed. The weather's actually, the way the weather's got now, they can kind of say, and it's looking good for the second week in July, apparently.
Well, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, well, don't take my word for it. Take the expert's word for it. But changeable next week, but it's looking decent for the week after. All right, thanks, Frankie. Back after the break. What happened at the weekend was a man, a young fella, I suppose you could say, not as young now as he used to be, of course, from a small town in Donegal, Ballybuffet, took to the top stage, or one of the top stages in boxing, a world stage, watched on DAZN by God knows how many people from all across the world. It is a remarkable achievement that really, really should be celebrated. It's one of the it's up there with some of the greatest sporting achievements by Irish sports stars, in my opinion. That person is Jason Quigley. And Jason, thanks for joining us. And it's kind of a strange one in that you're off the back of a defeat, but you know, the first word I want to say to you is congratulations. It was just an amazing performance, I think.
Yeah, thanks very much, Greg. Really appreciate it. Yeah, it is. It is a bit of a strange one. I think as the days are passing by, I'm starting to see things in a little bit of a different light. Of course, you know, I'm a fighter. I'm a competitive person, and once you get through those ropes, you always want to win. And you know, when you come out with a defeat, it never sits too well with you, no matter what way the fight went. But that's just the type of person that I am, and the type of game plan that we had, and the type of training that we put in, and training camp that we put in for this fight. You know, I really expected to get in there and pull off the upset, but you know, the result didn't go my way. But looking back on a few things, haven't watched the fight yet, but yeah, I have to say I'm happy with the direction my performance is going.
What did it feel like before we get to the fight itself? You know, after all the build-up and everything, you know, all the preparation, all the sacrifices, what does it feel like, you know, when the music goes, you're at the top of the stage and you look out and you're going down there? You're on, I mean, you've got your team, but you're on your own, but you've built yourself up to this. I always wonder what your heart rate would be at. That would be really interesting to me. But how does that feel?
It's actually... And like, obviously I can only speak for myself here when I do this, because I know everybody's different, but that's really when I come into my comfort zone. Do you know what I mean? That's really when I come into the place I want to be in, because, you know, the whole hanging around, like a day of the fight is the strangest day you'll ever come across. Like, because me and the team, you know, we wake up in the morning, we go for our breakfast. You come back, then you're chilling in the room. My wife April was over with me. We were lying up watching just Netflix, Black Mirror on Netflix throughout the day, just having a cup of tea, a wee coffee. You know, good positive distractions throughout the day, because you don't want to be wasting any nervous energy. You don't want to be thinking too much on the fight. At the end of the day, it's a job, and I didn't have to check into my job until 8 p.m. that night, and then it was 10 p.m. roughly by the time that I had to actually get to work. So it is definitely a weird day, fight day. And leading into the fight, you know, it can be strange, because you're sitting there, I was sitting there with April just having a coffee, a wee protein ball, and watching Black Mirror, head absolutely warped around Black Mirror. And next thing you're like, geez, we have a fight tonight. So it's strange, but once I get to the venue, I really become into like a real, not relaxed sense and such, because, you know, I just feel like I'm there to do what I'm meant to do. You know, that's when, you know, you can kind of control more whenever you're there. It's more the anticipation throughout the whole day and the fight week leading into the fight is what can be strange and difficult and hard to deal with. But you know, once it comes to, right, let's go to the venue, that's when everything starts coming together.
Now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what I saw as happening in the lead up to this fight, is that Edgar Berlanga is, you know, a big signing for DAZN. They wanted to showcase him on the platform, and they wanted a good fighter with a good winning record. But this was about, you know, Edgar Berlanga and his future. Now, you tore that script up, as far as I can imagine. But do you upset the script to some extent. Do you feel that that's the way this fight was being framed going in? I don't think there's any disrespect to you in that, Jason, but is that, like, you upset the party, really? There's just no doubt about that.
Yeah, you're spot on there, Greg, definitely, you know, because, like, that's boxing, that's the game we're in, and it's crazy to, like, there's a brilliant saying that goes around in boxing, you're only as good as your last fight. And you know, that is so true in boxing, because I was, you know, remembered really for the Andrade fight. Oh, it was great, Jason Coyle got the fight for world title, but he was knocked out in the second round. Like, you know, I didn't want to be remembered for that. Like, that wasn't, I know I'm better than that. I know that was an off night. It was just boxing happened that night. And, you know, I really wanted to put a mark back on my name, put a bit of respect back on my name, put a bit of authority behind my name again. From what I put into the sport and how good that I know I am and how good I know I can be. But this was the perfect opportunity for me to do that, because Edgar Belanga was he's supposedly the chosen one. You know, he's the one that is, you know, gunning for Canelo. But me and my team really worked so hard, gelled together throughout the whole training camp, throughout the whole year, really, and really came into this fight with a real sense of confidence about us, and what we could do. And we knew we could upset the odds. We knew we had it in us, and we had the capability of doing that.
And I think it was very clear from, and also people are saying, oh, Berlingo was under par. I don't think so. I think exactly the way you and Andy Lee figured this out, you exposed his weaknesses big time. You stopped him working. You frustrated him. I don't think he was under par. I just think you outwitted him. But the one thing that, and I'm a huge fan of Andy Lee, and particularly the fight he had in that ring not so long ago. I think it was the 9th round or something. He pulled off an amazing victory. But it was, he's so cool, calm and collected. And the way he was speaking to you, the way he was trying to say, look, we've talked about this in advance. We know what we have to do here, Jason. And if you stick to it, we're going to do it. And you responded really well to that. It was remarkable to see how you two interacted in the corner, and how this plan, you know, coming out low and all that kind of stuff, how this plan was working when you were on it. And you showed amazing discipline, Jason, too, because we talked the last time we talked about it, that sometimes you can just say, well, stuff the plan, let's have a row. But you were really, really disciplined. And I can't imagine how much concentration it takes to stay as you did for so long.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, that we have been really working on. That's something that I had been subject to doing in the past, is, you know, getting into a war, getting into a tussle, and just, you know, saying, F this, like, you know what I mean? And just going for it.
Watch the 12th round, because you kind of did do that, all right? So skip that, and maybe fast forward round 10. So 1, 2, 9 and 11, skip 10 and 12, Jason.
It was, you know, me and Andy, you know, Andy has got a little bit of stick in the past for being my coach because of certain circumstances, not being able to
travel,
you know,
and stuff,
get into the States, yeah, and travel. And, you know, people has said that he's let me down, and, you know, your coach not being there is a massive disadvantage and stuff like that. But nobody's seen the one-to-one that me and Andy has had. No one's seen the work that me and him put in, the conversations, the coffees we've had, the, you know, spending time together outside of boxing as well, and just growing that relationship and seeing how much that he does care, and, you know, seeing how much that he does put into me. And I think people now realize the reason why I have stuck by Andy, and, you know, we got over the hurdles that needed to get over for this fight, and got him into the country and got him in the visa sorted. So, you know, it's been a massive, massive advantage, as people have seen, you know, having Andy there, not only just because of, like, he's my coach and the training camp and the game plan and all that there that we put through in his boxing IQ, but, you know, Andy has been there. He's been in that ring. He has been the underdog. He has come through it. He knows exactly what it takes, you know, to get to that top level. And you know, it was unbelievable to have him there. Yeah. And another lad, you know, that has recently come a part of the team is Shane O'Sullivan, a Waterford man. You know, he's actually a hurler, plays with Ballet Gunner, All-Ireland champions, played with Waterford County Hurling as well in the past. But, you know, he's come on board as a sports psychologist for me, and has been a massive positive to the team as well over the last year or so. And, you know, the team has really grown so strong. With Gary McCullough there, still part of the team, Sean Foley, part of the team, you know, my management, Robert Diaz, everybody. Like, it was one of the first times that I really had that solid base, that solid full team around me. And it showed in my performance. It showed in the fight week. And, you know, what you were saying there as well, I don't know, was it this question or the previous one, Greg? But, you know, Berlanga was the man, you know what I mean? He was the one that was hyped up. But as you seen the first face-off, the press conference, the weigh-in, everything, the tide started turning as it got closer to the fight. People started to, yes, people were writing me off, but people seen that I was there, I meant business. There was no hanging around after the face off. There was no hanging around after the weigh-in, after the press conference. I was in, did what I had to do, showing that I was there, showing them that I meant business, and we were out the door, back to the hotel, switching off, doing what I had to do, and then getting ready for fight night.
All right, just a couple of things as it relates to the fight. You seemed almost bigger than him on fight night. Was that just the way it appeared on TV, or did you rehydrate, put on a lot of weight or whatever? I just imagined him being much bigger than you on fight night. But
yes, so like that's been a big conversation that has been going on before the fight and since the fight. Everybody thought that Berlanga was going to be the bigger man and everything like that, but you know, I have been boxing at 75 kg since I was in my early 20s as an amateur, and when I turned professional, middleweight is actually 72.5 kgs. So I have been actually boxing at a lower weight than I was whenever I was in my early 20s, which, you know, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because you naturally develop, you naturally fill out.
So super middleweight is your
super middleweight, yes,
ideal weight. Okay.
That is my ideal weight. That's 76 kgs, 76.2 kgs, yeah. You know, 168 pound. But like, I've really filled into this weight, and not only just looks wise, you know, just looking big and looking strong. Like, the whole fight week wasn't based around making weight. Okay, we got to do this session because we have to make weight. Did one training session on Thursday night just to make weight, and every other session that we did when we were in New York was just meticulously going over the game plan, the mindset, the focus, switching on for that hour and a half in the evening time, just focusing, drilling, doing everything that we had to be prepared and focused for the fight. And then everything else outside of that was switched off and just chilling, enjoying it and taking everything in. But super middleweight is definitely the weight for me. It was the much, you know, style-wise, people might say, oh, Berlanga looked a stronger fighter, but that's because he's a come-forward fighter, and he is a strong fighter. He's a strong physical hard puncher, and that's the type of style that he has. But, you know, even in the warm-up, the week of the fight, like, I just felt, and Andy was saying, like, you know, just hitting the pads, like, you could really feel the power now.
Yeah, and you had him going at least on two or three occasions. Just in terms of the tactics, you had your glove in his face. He didn't like it. He tried to slap it out a couple of times, and you kept that going, as I say, for the most part, for at least 10 of the 12 rounds. Is that to frustrate a come-forward boxer, to keep him sort of, you know, off, not off balance as such, but just sort of have something to think about all the time? Because I think it's seemingly a little thing, but it seemed to play actually really quite an important part in the fight.
Yeah, it was just something that it was kind of going back a little bit to me whenever I was kind of, you know, as an amateur, and, you know, people couldn't get in on top of me, and people couldn't get
crowd
inside
you too
me
much
because,
yeah,
you know, whenever you have, like, they say, you know, your jab is the key to boxing. You know, it's the key to open up all the doors. And, you know, having that jab, and it wasn't only really the jab, it was the stance, it was the way that we had it, you know, tweaked to look imposing, to make him double think about always, you know, once he made a move, he had to know that he was in danger. Like, with me having my hands at that stage and having my eyes gearing down on him, like, he knew that he couldn't just walk forward. He was going to get hit if he did. So he had to be willing to take a few shots, to land a few shots. And that definitely played a vital part for the fight, yeah, because, you know, he definitely thought twice. And then when I did hit him and when I did rock him, you know, that was a key moment in the fight.
Yeah, when you do watch it back, contrast your corner to his corner. It's hilarious, really. It's a very, very different atmosphere in the opposite.
Yeah.
And I'll not keep you very much longer, Jason. Just in terms of your conditioning, as well, watching it, I thought, right, I mean, you weren't on your bike, right? But your tactics required, you know, to be on your toes for much of the fight. I didn't think you'd be fit to do it. You pretty much did. Your conditioning is unbelievable. You're a young fighter, but in terms of boxing terms, do you know what I mean? You've still got plenty to go, but, you know, your conditioning's something else.
Yeah, it's something, you know, that and I hope that there's young athletes, young sports people that are listening here today, because it's not all about how much you do. Do you know what I mean? Fitness can be a lot in your head mentally. Whenever you're in competition, if you're hyped up, you know, if you're not in that flow state, if you're not in that state of being focused on the job at hand, you know, Andy says a great one, the more you work, the less you have to work. You know, it's like, yeah, the more I was focused, the more that I was tuned in on what I was doing, the quicker the fight was going by, the more I was in control. And like, I have actually scaled my training back a little bit over the years to what I used to do, because to be honest, I think sometimes I was overtrained. Sometimes I was, you know, a bit burned out going into fights, whereas I've really tweaked my training now. And yes, you know, it's a big thing, you know, in terms with Andy, the training that we've been doing, and Sean Foley here in the Finn Balor Center, and Gary and Rafo as well there. Like with me and Sean, like, we've been really working to build my frame as well to fit into the super middleweight division. So we've been focusing a little bit more on the strength and conditioning side of things, but just putting in that meticulous work. Like, if you're doing the rounds in the gym, do you know what I mean? If you're doing the rounds on the bag, on the pads, you know, a lot of people just think that they need to be doing more and more and more and more all the time. Sometimes less is more, if you can just keep the head and keep that nervous energy controlled.
Yeah, and just two more questions. The cards had it 116, 108, 116, 108, 118, 106. There was one knockout, one knockdown that wasn't a knockdown. I'm not sure. I think it was the one in the fifth, and there could have been a touchdown the other way. And I mean, yes, there were two knockdowns in the 12th, but that can only, as far as I'm aware, be counted as a 10-7. Like, do you think those scorecards are unfairly wide there? It's certainly 118, 106. I just don't like this subjective type of scoring that we're seeing now in terms of, oh, well, you know, power punches over jabs or aggression over more defensive style. I just wish that could be normalized so we know exactly what we're going to get, because this is the third week of, as far as I would see, main card dodgy cards.
Yeah. The boxing game, it is very, I suppose, you know, it's very abstract in terms of judges. In my fight, I have to say now, you know, the knockdowns did play a massive part in it. To be honest, I think there was only two real knockdowns. One of them was a push to the dot, and one of them was definitely a trip, like, you know. I tripped over my own feet.
No, you could see that, yeah.
And one of them, like, and I was very shocked. And also, there was three legitimate low blows as well. And I'm not a man to make excuses, no way whatsoever.
Well, my eyes watered. There was one where you were sort of on the off the hard side of the camera, and I'll tell you one thing. That will take a little bit of time to recover from, I think, because it was right there in the family jewels. Family allowance, Jason.
You know, it was something like that, that they could have easily have took a point or two off Berlanga for that.
Do you
know what
I mean? Yeah.
We knew what we were going into. We knew we were going into his hometown. We knew his manager is a New Yorker and has a lot of pull over there in the New York State Commission, and we knew we would be up against it in that terms. But, you know, looking at the zone, the commentary and some of the scorecards, they actually had me up going into the last round.
Oh, for sure.
On the scorecards. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, it is what it is. And I think, just going to your question, Greg, on talking about scoring, like, I think it should be explained. And I think the judges should possibly in the future be interviewed after a fight or told before a fight which way they're going to be judging the fight. Are they going to be looking for the aggressive fighter? Are they going to be looking for the clean punched fighter? You know, what way is it? Because boxing is a sport that everybody looks at it in a different way. You know, if you're landing good, clean punches, my own personal opinion is boxing is hit and don't get hit. If I hit you more times than you hit me, I'm winning.
That's it. You know. And we're not talking about pouring jabs either. We're talking about, you know, actual punches. And you out. But now, if you put up the power shots because of the style of his fighting, yeah, okay. Yeah. But if you're looking at jabs, it was either equal or you were ahead in that. Right, Jason, listen, I've taken up too much of your time, but I want to know what's next. And I think this is quite be an interesting insight to your psychology on this and where you see your career going now. Because, listen, there's no doubt that that performance gets you into a big marquee fight. Or, you know, there is a pathway to a world title in different directions. Do you know what I mean? So where do you want to go with your career now? Is it the big show that maybe you'll go in as a heavy underdog again? Or is it a pathway and perhaps an easier pathway, maybe a 2 or 3 fight pathway to becoming, you know, a fully fledged world champion? What do you want to do next? Or maybe both of those are the same thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting now. You know, I am in a really good position and I have put a bit of credit back on my name. I got a bit of respect back on my name again and put myself right back up there. And, you know, I was messaging Eddie Hearn the day after the fight and everything as well. We had a good conversation. To be honest, Greg, I haven't thought too much on what is next or where we're going to go next. I am going to... Obviously got married, didn't get away on our honeymoon yet. So that's the first and foremost now at the minute. We're going to get ready to see what the crack is and where we're going to jet off for our honeymoon. But I'm really enjoying what I'm doing now. I'm enjoying where I'm going in my career. I'm enjoying the training. I'm enjoying the dieting as well, believe it or not. I'm enjoying everything that I'm doing right now. And there's a real new sense of life about me. And I think that shows in my performances. So I believe that I am coming into probably my peak of my career now. And I know it would be a shame to maybe walk away at this stage from that. So it's something that I have to really think about now over the next couple of weeks. But the future is very bright for me. There's a lot of big fights out there. There is definitely a chance and a potential of getting that world title fight again.
What about you against someone like Billy Joe Saunders and as an eliminator? Yeah. I would love to see that.
Something like as soon as you mentioned that, like it's something that makes me smile. And you know, these are the type of fights that excite me, and these are the type of fights that bring out the best in me as well, Greg. Like, fight the likes of Billy Joe would be great.
That would be, and I'd put your favorite going into that.
But that's an arena fight in
Britain.
100%. And I know Katie Taylor is going to be back fighting in Ireland again in November. So, you know, been talking to Eddie there. Nothing really said or nothing, you know, spoke about that yet. But
I've stumbled on the plot, Jason. Because he's looking for a good opponent for him too. So it's perfect.
You know, it's definitely something that we can get excited about now. The future is bright. Yeah. Everything's looking great. So, it's just we gotta just stay disciplined now. One day at a time and keep moving on in life.
Right, go on. I'll let you finish Black Mirror and book your honeymoon.
Appreciate that, lad.
Take care.
I'll send you a postcard.
Yeah, go on, you do it. Take care. All right, that's Jason Quigley there. And it's brilliant to be speaking to Jason off the back of a defeat, but boxing's a funny old game in that his stock has risen. And arguably, Berlanga's, who was looking for big fights against the likes of Canelo and all, he's not going to get that, I don't think, off the back of that performance. But Billy Joe Saunders, Jason Quigley, for any boxing fans out there, I think... and listen, a long chat with Jason because, as I say, not everyone is into every sport, but what he did at the weekend really was a remarkable achievement, and I think it needed to be recognised. OK, back after the break. Now, the ICSA has warned meat factories that their continued assault, as they describe it, on beef prices is having a devastated effect on farm level and causing immense frustration amongst farmers. The situation with beef prices has reached a tipping point. Right, John Cleary, Vice Chair of the ICSA, that's the Irish Cattle and Sheep Farmers Association Beef Committee, joins us now. How are you getting on, John?
Hi, good morning, Greg.
Right. So this is, strong language that's being used here. What's the message, really, outside of what I said, that you're sending to the factories?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We follow on, you know, from your previous interviewer there. Maybe we should be putting on the boxing gloves at this stage ourselves. But all joking aside, yes, the beef situation in Ireland is at a very low ebb. We have always been advised to keep an eye on the Boar B tracker pricing right across Europe and global price markets. And they were never as buoyant abroad, but we seem to be getting the raw end of the stick here. They have been in free fall for virtually the last 3 or 4 months of this year. And, you know, we have been sort of, the meat processors in this country have been sort of advocating, you know, that continue on driving on producing beef. We need it in May and June. And never before have we been let down as bad as the last period of 2 months. You know, cattle that were bought in the springtime now are virtually losing money hand over fist. And even in our own situation, the last few weeks there, you know, cattle are not even at a break-even stage. So it's very disillusioning to the whole beef producers in this country. And, you know, who knows where it's going to end and whether it's just being geared up, you know, for the autumn supply of cattle is coming. We really don't know. But, you know, in the northern part of this island, you know, prices were never as good. And across the water, which, you know, we send 50 to 55% of our export into the UK, prices were never as strong. So it's very hard for farmers to understand the present situation.
Well, who's squeezing? I mean, obviously it's farmers that are paying the price, but who's squeezing here?
Well, you know, farmers have been squeezed and squeezed, and, you know, this term has been used, you know, quite to our disadvantage all along. We have been sort of plying the trade there, you know, that watching markets, looking for niche markets, supplying high spec end quality food. And, you know, processors and supermarkets are the other side of the table. And it comes down to, is it them or is it us? I personally think, you know, that the markets are strong out there. I know food prices were never as expensive to consumers, but at the end of the day, you know, on €100 or £100 a week shopping basket, food prices have really only increased £7 or £8, which, you know, in the general scheme of things is a relatively small increase when you look at energy costs, leisure activity costs, everything else. And, you know, I feel food, especially in this country where we depend so much on export markets, really are, you know, the old line that we're price takers all along. But what has been going on in recent months is a huge travesty to Irish farmers. And it is eventually at the stage there now where it's going to totally discourage people from producing, you know, this quality food. And listening to an earlier radio program there, you know, all about nature preservation and all of that, you know, that there's a huge onus on meat processors and government departments to encourage food production and to make sure that whatever is available at the marketplace is passed down to the producer.
Yeah. There seems to be an ongoing problematic relationship between factories and farmers in terms of messaging. You know, I've covered these stories over the years, and, you know, the factories advise farmers one way and then move the goalposts another way. This time around, I think it was advising farmers to feed cattle for May and June. You know what I mean? Like, if there was trust there, has it broken down now?
Yeah, well, for the last 18 months, you know, prior to maybe March, April, you know, the industry was on a positive note. But now, this old saying of one step forward and two step backwards, it has really taken three steps backwards at this stage, because never before were our input costs as high. And, you know, when you have meat hovering around €400 a ton and silage costs and day-to-day running costs never as high, you know, it's incumbent on meat processors to return to farmers the best available price.
All right, John, finally, John, I mean, you can do interviews like this, and we welcome you on, don't get me wrong, and you can lobby and you can make representations and you can call for this, that and then. But really, you know, if we're at a tipping point here, what can farmers do then? What are farmers in this country capable of doing it to put it up to the factories to make their point other than verbalising it? Do you know what I mean, John? Is there a plan of action? What can be done?
Well, you know, our hands are literally tied to a certain extent. And you have a minister coming from your own constituency up there. You know, he was queried the other day there about the level of imports, of beef imports coming into this country. And he made a flippant reply, in my view. You know, that is business. You know, we're export and import country. But the equivalent of 40,000 tons of beef coming in here in one quarter, and put that over a 12-year average, is the equivalent of all the live exports that go out of this country. So in other words, at one full swoop then, all the work that goes into promoting live exports all over Europe and Northern Africa is just completely cancelled out. And we just wonder why meat processors, stroke importers, feel the need to bring in so much beef into this country. We're a main exporting nation, and where we export, where we have available.
John, I mean, with all due respect, you're answering your own questions. Firstly, you said earlier on, why would anyone get into the industry or stay in it? They want you out. Secondly, even if we import all the beef in the world, still, if they can get rid of farmers like yourself and others and meet emissions targets, that's job done. You know, it's not, it's look over there. It doesn't matter if we're importing beef, as long as they can show on the books that agriculture now is responsible for a fraction of our output, say, for an example. So really, the truth be told, they want you to jack it in.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if the beef comes from Brazil, because that doesn't really matter.
That's a very sad state of affairs, you know, for an island that has kept this country afloat through many's a time when needs were most. And, you know, to look across the green plains of Ireland, to now allow it to turn into a wilderness.
It's going to be forestry and solar panels. That's what's going to replace the green fields of Ireland.
Isn't that amazing, you know? And they will allow then the desecration of the Amazon, and to allow then the South American farmers then to supply food then of a dubious nature up here, where they're using all sorts of additives in one shape or form to get kilos of beef and animals, and to forego then all the good work that's been done here for the last 40 or 50 years. It's an absolute disgrace. Now, I'm at the stage in my life, you know, where you know, I come in near retirement age. But for any young person to be encouraged to go into farming, I think agriculture is way down the agenda.
You throw fishing in there as well, by the way.
Absolutely. Now, it's ironic you should say that, because it is impossible to get good quality fish in the middle. And just before I came on air, I was talking to a supplier down in Clare, and I am prepared to travel 100 kilometres once a month to collect good quality fish. And he was amazed with my reaction, because the only fish that's available in the Midlands here is virtually imported stuff from fish farms. Okay.
We have to leave it there. Thanks for your time. I just think it's time that, certainly in the media, if it's not already happening, that the situation, that the reality that is happening in this country is actually called out. Do you know what I mean? That the call out, what is actually going on here? Right, John, thanks for your time. John Cleary there, Vice Chair of the ICSA. Thanks so much for listening to the show today. We're going to do it all again tomorrow morning from 9. Have a lovely day from me, Caroline and Niamh. Stay tuned.